I know during the initial time that the band was together, things didn't seem to really go that well, but what point did you sort of sense that the tide had turned and people were interested in the band sort of after the fact, and that, you know, that its influence was growing and becoming an important part of the canon, really? You know, like, when was that, early 80s?
Well, actually, it was prior to that.
The first big signal, and it took me by surprise. The Big Star Resurgence almost was fed back from the UK to here. And it was 1978, and somebody asked me, did you know that EMI had licensed Number One Record in Radio City and put them out as a double fold-out vinyl in England? I said, no, I had no idea that they had done that. He said, well, do you know people in England are paying $75 a piece for original vinyls if they can find them? I said, no, I didn't realize that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, still, I thought it was a little bit of an aberration. It's kind of funny that the EMI record, David Bell, Chris's brother, told me a little while ago, said the two things that Chris was most proud of was his little car 45 with Cosmos on one side and you and your sister are on the other side. And when he saw that double fold-out vinyl, the fact that it said EMI Records, Hayes, Middlesex, England, just like it did on a Beatles record. But, you know, that was really the first indication. And then about the same time, people started bugging me about, well, isn't there a third record? Isn't there some kind of third record that didn't come out? And so there was a vinyl issue of that in Europe and in the United States. And what was then Fantasy, they were very slow to get off the ground on getting Number One Record in Radio City out in the United States on CD. Ace was their distributor in the UK, and they leapt at it, you know, as soon as CD was around. And you know, it's 2 or 3 years later before they kind of noticed, oh, well, it seems to be some activity in England. You know, we started to see bands covering songs and, you know, hearing comments from artists and interviews and, you know, more and more of that stuff. The Bangles covered September Girls on an album that sold maybe 3 million, you know. But it was just kind of a slow process, and I think that's the most interesting thing about the whole Big Star story is that it all seems to have happened organically or spontaneously. There was no big commercial engine or marketing budget that was behind all of these things occurring and trying to make them occur. They just did. And, you know, early 90s, that 70s show picks up what essentially is In the Street for the theme song, plus they used no telling how many, you know, Big Star songs in the background through 8 seasons of that program. So, you know, it's just a gradual process that I never would have imagined. The band getting back together to play live was literally
a miracle.
Yeah, well, it was simply just an accident. You know, Jody was working here by then, and some kid from a college in Columbia, Missouri, calls up to Jody and says, "We want Big Star to play." Joey says, "You don't understand. There isn't any band. You know, it broke up in 1975. There's nobody to play." You know, after a while, they call back and they say, "We really want Big Star to play, and we have this much money." So, you know, then it's time to ring Alex up on the phone. "Hey, want to play?" And the neat part about it is that would have been very hard to put together, but we had only a short time before kind of discovered the Posies. You know, they sent us a Sub Pop 45 that had Feel on one side and I'm the Cosmos on the other. And so all you have to do is go there and get Ken Stringfellow and John Auer. They already know the repertoire, so it's kind of like instant Big Star band.
And was there a chemistry with those guys fairly quickly when you were playing with them again?
Sure. Yeah, for me, I mean, instantly. Mm-hmm. You know, they'd been singing and performing together for a few years by that time, and as John Hampton might say, there was some genetic harmony there with their voices. I mean, their voices worked really well, and certainly worked well within the context of Big Star songs. And actually, just to make a small correction, the folks at the University of Missouri didn't offer us any money. They just said, hey, we'll cover your expenses. And that's why I thought, well, you know, I don't know that this is going to happen. I said, I'll be glad to do it if Alex will agree. And they found Alex's number, and Alex indeed agreed to do it. And then, you know, as John said, we'd gotten the Posies, been introduced to the Posies, and that single, and it was, those songs were so close to the originals, they, you know, would give you goosebumps. Well, I'd spent some time in, maybe I'm making a short story long, but oddly enough, I went to, I'd saved my money for a couple of years and went to England in 78. So I was there when EMI reissued the first two Big Star albums as a double album. And my first inclination was, I picked up a music publication, probably New Musical Express or Sounds or Melody Maker or something, and there was some mention of Big Star in the back, somebody looking for Big Star records. And then there was an interview with Alex in one, and there always seemed to be something, some mention of Big Star. And then, but really what made me scratch my head was I ran into who was a fairly well-known writer in England, a guy named Nick Kent, kind of famous or infamous writer, and just ran into Nick on the street in London, and actually he was wearing a leather suit, and the sun was out and it was hot, and I'm thinking, well, that's the sacrifice for fashion. But at any rate, you know, Nick starts talking about I've got the bootleg of Big Star, the WLIR broadcast, which hadn't been released by Rhino, and he actually had the third album prior to its being released, and so these things were available as a bootleg. Mm-hmm. So that was my sort of first inclination to all that. Yeah.